Hello, this is Audio Cassette 1, Side 2 for the D315 course. I'm Dr. Sean Damer of the Sociology Department at the University of Glasgow and a D315 course tutor. Chapter 4 of Book 1, The Problem of Crime, focuses on the city as a dangerous place. It raises general themes of order and disorder, the way these are represented or signified, and the place of crime in these representations. From the 19th century onwards, the city has been consistently perceived as a place containing dangerous classes of people living in dangerous places. These people and these places are not only dangerous, they are, or are at least potentially, criminal. They represent the dark forces of disorder which threaten the day-to-day order of the city. In this discussion, I would like to suggest that not only can neighbourhoods within the city be represented as dangerous, but indeed whole cities can be so represented. And I will take my city, the city of Glasgow, as an example. In 1999, the external image of Glasgow is by and large positive. It is perceived as being a warm, friendly, dynamic city full of gallus punters who all talk like Billy Connolly. But this image is relatively recent, in fact, barely 10 years old. A historical perspective shows that over the last 200 years or so, the image of Glasgow has undergone a dramatic series of changes. When I say image, I am referring to the external general perception of the city, in other words, the mental picture of Glasgow entertained by non-Glaswegians, particularly those from south of the border. This alerts us to the fact that the city's image is something which is socially constructed. And like all social constructions, it is contested. So what does the trajectory of Glasgow's image look like in historical terms? Before even answering this question, think about what kind of data we would look for in methodological terms that would tell us something about external perceptions of Glasgow. A key source would have to be literary representations of Glasgow in both fictional and non-fictional forms. In 1799, Glasgow was perceived as a thriving town dominated by the textile industry. It was a prosperous town of considerable architectural elegance. William and Dorothy Wordsworth visited it in 1803 and observed,
"The Trongate, an old street, is very picturesque. High houses with an intermixture of gable fronts towards the street. The new town is built of fine stone, in the best style of the very best London streets at the west end of the town, but not being of brick, they are greatly superior."
But within 50 years this image had been utterly transformed. Here is a description of the city in 1849.
"It is in those frightful abodes of human wretchedness which lay along the High Street, Salt Market and Bricket, and constitute the bulk of that district known as the Wynds and Closes of Glasgow, that all sanitary evils exist in perfection. They consist of ranges of narrow closes, only some 4 or 5 feet in width and of great length. The houses are so lofty that the direct light of the sky never reaches a large proportion of the dwellings. There is no drainage in these neighbourhoods except in a few cases, and from the want of any means of flushing, the sewers where they do exist are extended cesspools polluting the air. So little is house drainage in use that on one occasion I saw the entire surface of a back yard covered for several inches with green putrid water, although there was a sewer in the close within a few feet into which it might have been drained away."
What was responsible for the dramatic change in imagery in such a short space of time? There were two reasons. The first was the industrial explosion of Glasgow, the second was the population explosion. The availability of coal and iron ore on the one hand, and the River Clyde facing towards America on the other, meant that Glasgow was wide open to industrial expansion. It needed only labour power to fuel such expansion, and that was not long in coming. Glasgow was invaded in the first half of the 19th century initially by Highlanders fleeing the clearances and latterly by Irish fleeing the famine. By the end of the 19th century, the population of Greater Glasgow was well over 1 million people. Three quarters of this population, working class people, lived in grossly overcrowded single ends or rooms and kitchens. That is, single-roomed or two-room small tenement flats, most with outside toilets. Within the city, the sheer scale of the public health problems associated with such overcrowding forced the corporation to take on more and more municipal powers, fired by a Presbyterian zeal that cleanliness was indeed next to godliness. This phenomenon came to be known as municipal socialism, although there was not much that was socialist about it. The historian T.C. Smout sums this up wittily.
In Glasgow, a citizen may live in a municipal house. He may walk along the municipal street or ride in the municipal tram car and watch the municipal dust cart collecting the refuse, which is to be used to fertilise the municipal farm. Then he may turn into the municipal market, buy a steak from an animal killed in the municipal slaughterhouse, and cook it by the municipal gas stove. For his recreation, he can choose among municipal libraries, municipal art galleries, and municipal music in municipal parks.
But in spite of its slum housing problems, the industrial growth continued apace. Glasgow's heavy engineering and ship and locomotive building output was so massive that by the third quarter of the 19th century, it had developed a new, highly positive image as the second city of empire and the workshop of the world. Delegations came from North American cities like Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia to inspect Glasgow's colossal shipyards and foundries and marvel at the scale of its municipal enterprises. The self-confidence of the city was clearly signified by its external image and was also reflected in its literature. Moira Burgess is the preeminent bibliographer of Glasgow and analyst of Glasgow in fiction. Moira, to what extent was this commercial and industrial self-confidence reflected in the contemporary Glasgow novel?
Well, there's a lively picture of a self-confident mercantile Glasgow in a Victorian novel called St Mungo's City, published in 1884. The author, Sarah Tytler, in fact came from Fife and moved to London when she became well known as a writer. To that extent, this is an outsider's view. There is a slightly convoluted plot about a disputed inheritance, but probably the main interest to us is this picture of a bustling, enthusiastic, attractively naive 19th century Glasgow. We meet a young English visitor who's delighted with Glasgow life, its powerful vitality, innumerable lights and shades, and the magnitude of its achievements, which is rather a nice summing up of Glasgow's image at that time. A few years later, we find another loving depiction of the commercial world in Frederick Niven's Justice of the Peace, published in 1914, but describing things as they were a few years before, around the turn of the century. Niven knew this world well. He'd been an apprentice in a soft goods warehouse for some years, though his heart wasn't really in it. The main character is Ebenezer Moyer, the warehouse man and Justice of the Peace. He's shown as a most appealing man, kind and vulnerable for all his business skills. Niven, who also studied art at one time, has an artist's eye for his city, the streets, the buildings, the effects of light. And his Glasgow is a beautiful place, as well as a prosperous one.
The events of the First World War were to change all that. The emergence of a genuinely national British press in the 19th century was vital in this process. For it was the Victorian media which was critically responsible for the social construction of urban myths, such as the legendary competition between Edinburgh and Glasgow, for example, or the tight-fistedness of Aberdonians. By 1919, Glasgow was dammed thoroughly as the Red Clyde. A leader in the London Times of that year coined the phrase which was to last right up until the present day. The trouble started with the Labour militancy of the wartime years, with flashpoints in 1915 during the famous Glasgow rent strike, in 1916 with the sedition trial of John Maclean and other working class leaders, in 1918 with yet more trials, and ended with a 40-hour strike and pitched fighting on the streets on Bloody Friday, January the 31st, 1919. The image of the city was now one of a place full of belligerent communists and socialists hell-bent on turning Glasgow into Britain's St. Petersburg. The image was conveyed in striking newspaper photographs of helmeted troops patrolling with fixed bayonets, tanks in the city's cattle market, and machine gun posts on the roofs overlooking George Square. If it all sounds a bit dramatic now, we should not forget that 1919 was the year of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and that the British bourgeoisie was not alone in being alarmed about the intentions of the local working class movement.